Yo, everybody, welcome to episode 23 of Techish. I'm back again. This is Michael Bain, co-founder of People of Color and Tech.com, and I'm joined with
Abidassi, founder of Hustle Crew. I also work at Proctor.
Okay, let's throw that in there. Actually, we were going to start with the backstage capital story, but actually, I want to start with you had quite an important little meeting I saw on the social media world, so I want to know a little bit about it.
Yes, I did.
Go on, talk to me.
Yeah, I'm just dabbling in the world of political policy.
You know how
guys.
We do.
You know, casual.
Techish takeover.
Techish takeover the world. Well, as I mentioned in previous episodes of the podcast, I've been involved in a campaign alongside a number of other incredible Black women in tech and really just other supporters of inclusion. Deborah O'Kenla, who's the founder of Your Startup, Your Story, YSYS.
Shout out to Deborah.
Originally started a campaign, hashtag Where Are The Faces?
Yeah.
And it was really an open letter calling out, where are Black women? Whenever we speak about women in tech, it's very rarely intersectional. And by we, she just means society in general, mass media, that kind of stuff.
What was it that triggered it? There was like a London to America like type of event that happened with women founders, and it was predominantly white women, right?
Exactly. So you answered your own question.
There we go.
Nice. London and Partners effectively act as the mayor's offices, like branding company.
Yeah.
So it's their job to bring more foreign investment into London, whether that's students, businesses, or whatever. And a big part of what they do is send trade missions to Silicon Valley. So what they did was send, I think it was around 30 women founders to Silicon Valley. And the social media campaign that they decided to run with following it was called Behind Every Great City. So they ran this campaign saying, like, look, behind every great city are great women founders. And in the photograph that was being circulated across the press, not a single Black woman was in that. Mm. So we wrote an open letter signed by, you know, like I said, about 20 or so Black women founders. Another 30 or so allies of us from across the tech industry co-signed it too. Fast forward a few months later, we were invited to City Hall. So we had the deputy mayor, the mayor of business there, Natalie Campbell, who's part of Leap, which is involved in economic progress in London too, really kind of spearheaded it. I think if Natalie Campbell, a Black woman entrepreneur and, you know, someone with a prolific career and really active in the scene of startups, of entrepreneurship, and particularly of inclusion, I think if she hadn't already been in the organization and had the influence to open the doors or put the ladder down, I'm not sure how quickly it would have happened.
But, oh, seriously?
But yeah, I mean, it was great. So we were there. It was a roundtable discussion. It wasn't just us, as in the group that had written the letter. We also had representatives from like just other organizations that are connected to Black women in entrepreneurship. We set out some proposals for what could do better. For us, the biggest focus was access to capital.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of transparency around how a lot of the funding that the government has is being distributed.
Yeah.
So, here on the show, we quote a lot of the statistics around VC. You know, less than 2% of VC funding went to women in 2016. 0.0 something of that went to Black women, 0.8 or something crazy. Where is that data for the UK? We know it's small.
It doesn't exist.
But we need more transparency. If governments want to truly be inclusive, then they need to give us that information. Now, anecdotally, we're not getting it. Anecdotally, you know, Black women are going to pitches and being rejected, being invited to accelerators and incubators, being kicked out without any investment given to us. So what we're trying to say is, you know, there's pots, millions, multi-millions, even billions of pounds being directed to, you know, Teddy and Bobby.
I love
the
choice of names,
else.
Teddy and Bobby. Yeah, I get it.
But, you know, the generic tech bros.
Yeah.
And what we're saying is, you know, how do we fight these double standards? Because ultimately what's happening is a systemic type of discrimination.
I think it's, yeah, what you said is you guys really went on a good tact in a sense of, first we need to know what is the data. That data isn't widely reported or widely known. And maybe the government isn't keeping track of it because maybe they don't necessarily consider it a priority right now.
I agree.
That's probably why that debacle with the photo shoot happened. I call it the debacle because to me it is like that's outrageous that you would have not one Black woman in a picture of 30 women.
But that's also what happens when you don't have a single Black woman in a city like London, which is like almost 20% of the population is Black.
I think London
people.
London is majority minority.
Yeah, that's what happens when you have a leadership team in a very influential role, fully white and fully middle class. They didn't see a problem with that picture because privilege blinds us. So yeah, it was a great meeting. I mean, for me and like anyone listening, like I hope this example shows the power of community and the power of mobilization. You know, Black Lives Matter started as a WhatsApp group. Your Startup, Your Story started as a WhatsApp group. Even people of color in tech, like it's now thousands of members strong, and it wasn't, right? Originally, it just started just as you writing some articles and having an idea. So there is power when we come together over one cause. Like we might not have like capital or more traditional forms of power, but we have numbers and we have voices and we're very good at telling stories. Yeah, one story that I wanted to talk about, which is great news for all founders everywhere. Backstage Capital have announced their global accelerator coming to 4 cities, including London, Philadelphia, where we'll be in October. Shout out North Zone.
Plug that.
LA, City of Angels, and a 4th city to be determined based on votes.
Get voting, guys, if you want it to come to a city near you.
How exotic could it get? Wakanda.
Trust me. Or maybe like, a real African country. But it's really positive news. I mean, for us London folk, like there hasn't really been anything, and correct me if I'm wrong, Abba, that necessarily is targeting this kind of area. So essentially, for those who don't know, Backstage Capital focuses on investing in underestimated founders, as they like to call it. So women, people of color, LGBTQ.
We've had Arlen Hamilton on Tech.
We've had Arlen
before.
Yeah, go listen to that episode. That was a dope episode. Abba wasn't there, unfortunately, but
don't rub it in. Okay.
I wasn't rubbing it in. I was just
one
like,
of my idols,
right there,
isn't it?
Like,
it's fine.
It's all good. So, so they set up an accelerator in the sunny climate of London. And like I was saying, we just haven't had anything like this, as far as I can recollect.
We haven't, and it's very overdue. We have a big mismatch between the amount that we talk about it and then the amount of capital that's actually diverted into it. This is what we were talking about at City Hall. So you're absolutely right. It's the first time we have something like that. It's incredible the amount of momentum Arlen Hamilton and her team have been able to create around underestimated founders and the opportunities there. First, it was the fund, the It's About Damn Time fund, $30 million, right, for Black
women
founders.
That wasn't first. At first, it was just that she just scrapped.
Oh, I just mean
hustled.
This year.
Oh, this year, right.
In
yeah,
this
yeah,
year
yeah,
alone.
Yeah, for real, you're
like,
right.
Like, she has dominated the headlines in terms of, like, VCs making moves.
Yeah,
and it's 100%. Like, it's just the beginning of September.
Real talk.
And now we've got this fund. I think, like you said, the exciting thing about it is it's just transparent and it's clear and we know how to get the money. $100,000 in exchange for 5% equity. I mean, it's simple. What was really inspiring as well was the fact that like they've basically been doing scouting for accelerators since the beginning of Backstage Capital. She was saying, Arlen Hamilton, like when the news broke out, I think it broke out at the Disrupt conference, right?
Yeah, the TechCrunch.
Yeah. So she basically said how she must have handed tens of thousands of leads to Seed Camp, Techstars, 500 startups, all the other, you know, Y Combinator, all the other accelerators that we know. And she was like, you know, this time I'm just going to do it for myself. And I think what's cool about that is like every few months I'll get a founder into my Twitter inbox telling me about their failed attempt to get into Y Combinator, 500 startups, any other accelerator. More often than not, the numbers they have are really, really strong. But where they're falling down is on pattern matching, either because they themselves don't come from that traditional background that VCs look for, or because they're trying to like serve a market that
it's not well understood by mainstream investors, essentially.
Exactly. So what I think is fantastic about this is those founders still should have that opportunity to be in an accelerator environment, learn from experts, get these incredible benefits that their competitors have when it comes to cloud storage, cloud services, et cetera, et cetera. So,
and the mentorship.
Agreed.
And the mentorship.
Well, it's just one more thing to level the playing field in terms of tech founders, and we need that.
Yeah, so we'll put everything in the show notes regarding maybe how to apply. If you want to vote for your city to have it, I know us London folks are real happy, so maybe you want that in your city. If you've got a city that hasn't got this kind of infrastructure set up already, get voting. And follow Arlen Hamilton and Backstage on Twitter. Shout out to them. So I think we have to cover the Facebook and Twitter hearings. I think actually it wasn't meant to just be Facebook and Twitter hearings. Google was meant to be there.
Interesting.
And Google didn't send anybody of a high enough level. So
too cool for school.
What the people in the hearings did, this isn't the US Senate, I guess. What they did, which I thought was good optics, is that they left an empty chair for Google and put their logo there just to embarrass them.
Wow.
Yeah, just to embarrass them. And also, I think because in the States, you're not legally mandated to go. Whereas in the UK, you are. If you're requested to appear in front of such a body, you have to.
Yeah.
And they said to Zuckerberg, I mean, a year ago, or however many months ago, this year's racing past, that they asked him to come to the UK one and he didn't want to go. He said, what's the, like, I guess he kind of brushed him off.
That.
And they said that if you don't come,
Cambridge Analytica,
we're going to pick you up at the airport next time you get here, type thing.
Wow. Really.
But anyway, I digress. The whole point is that, yeah, it's not legally mandated to have to go. So Google, they don't want to send anybody of a high enough level, Sergey or Larry. So they weren't happy. And the Senate hearing wasn't happy with who they wanted to send. I think it was some VP or something, whatever. And so they left an empty chair. I think that was great optics to kind of embarrass Google.
So to set the scene for anyone who doesn't know the details of the story, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg and Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey had to appear before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
There we go.
To discuss foreign interference and fake news on social media.
Right.
This was the fourth hearing in a series of hearings.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking.
All around social media.
Cool.
Russian interference in US elections. I mean, Cambridge Analytica was linked to Russian interference.
100%, yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Propaganda.
Yeah.
Fake accounts. I think what's really interesting about this is that Mark Zuckerberg was not there. He sent Sheryl Sandberg in his place. Mm. Is that because he's still trying to be president? And not on my watch.
I think he realizes that she... It's better.
she's more human.
I think Kara Swisher said that, like, no, it wasn't her. She said the opposite. They said, why doesn't he send Sandberg? Because she's the grown-up. And then Kara Swisher was like, well, Mark Zuckerberg's a 30-year-old man. He's also a grown-up. But there is a perception that Sandberg is the real deal in terms of handling these kind of things. She's the MBA, whereas Zuckerberg is seen as the kid that just made something in a scrappy in his bedroom.
He also is kind of seen, like, no hate to the Zuck or whatever his nickname. Do you think he has a nickname?
I don't think so.
Marky Mark.
Great t-shirt, man.
He might have a nickname. He might have, like, a sweet nickname amongst his friends. And we'll never know. But I think it's not even the fact that he is young or appears young. We've spoken about
which he's not, which we just said, basically. Exactly. He's 30 plus.
It's more that he doesn't appear human. Like, no matter what he does, like, sorry, Zuck, so you know this is true.
Yeah.
No matter what he does, it becomes memeable.
Yeah.
Like, when he was, at that hearing, there was that scene where he, like, sipped a bit of water. Do you remember?
Of course, yeah.
And people were like, what?
He looks like Data from Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Literally.
He's like a robot, essentially, right?
And then there's that video of Mark eating toast.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, you need to see that video.
What's wrong
he
with it?
Takes a piece of toast out of a toaster. He doesn't even put anything on it. No spread, no jam, no peanut butter, no Marmite. Just starts nibbling on the toast, man.
That's crazy. I'll go watch
he's
it.
Not human.
Maybe he's not. But the overall point is that, yeah, Sandberg is more relatable.
Jack Dorsey and, like, Twitter in general have, like, come under fire over the last few months. It started with the ban, or rather not the ban, of Alex Jones, and, like, a few other things. Like, it took them so long to delete fake accounts. They did finally do it, but it took them a long time. It's interesting. I certainly feel that, like, I have a difficult relationship with Twitter. Like, while I love the platform on the one hand and it's integral to all of the work that I do, I do also feel that their determination to remain neutral and, like, not get involved is just a bit too hard a pill to swallow because
they're jarring.
Yes, because they're not neutral, really, are they? Yeah, I mean, they might say they are, but they're still facilitating certain behaviors.
So when you say neutral, you mean by not banning certain accounts and,
exactly.
and enabling people to have voices that probably racist, sexist, homophobe, whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're trying to remain politically neutral
right.
for the most
part. I mean, they did ban Jones.
Yeah.
They did in the end, right? Milo Yiannopoulos. And actually, Alex Jones was there at the hearing. And he
what?
Yeah,
like a cheerleader?
Yeah. No, actually,
for
he...
For the government?
So, you know, Marco Rubio is, like, a Florida senator, I think.
Yes.
And he basically was having a press conference outside. And Alex Jones ran up on him and was like, yo, are we saying, like, as in, like, just trolling him? And then it got a bit testy. Alex Jones put his hand on his shoulder and Marco Rubio was like, don't touch me. Like, and then
Whoa.
Alex Jones was like, I'm going to have you arrested. And he was like, no, are you going to have me arrested? And he goes, no, I'll handle it myself. And it's like, it got really, like, playground-ish. But anyways.
What is going on
Yeah,
there?
What is going on? It's crazy. But so yeah, Twitter came under fire in the thing. And both Sandberg and Dorsey basically were saying the same thing, which is that, you know, we were slow to react to this and we're getting on board with it. And Jack Dorsey tweeted out essentially that, listen, we started this platform 12 years ago. We were just a bunch of kids. Like, we didn't know
what, but that was 12 years ago. Grow up. Kids are being thrown in jail for smaller things.
Yeah, real talk. But at the same time, there is an element where people in the Valley don't understand the ramifications of what they're building. And we're not necessarily taught the ethics. I think, listen, it's how can we raise as much money as possible and get rich, as far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
And there might be some element of let's change the world. And, you know, for example, Mark Zuckerberg, I think the best example I heard was when they invented Facebook live streaming on the app. They showed it to the journalist, and the journalist was like, what are you going to do if somebody like shoots
kills
somebody?
Himself.
Or does some kind of violence. And they were like, what are you talking about? Like, why are you so negative? And it's like, they don't
They hadn't thought of it.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. They haven't thought of the ethics and the ramifications of their products that they've built. They've just gone as fast as in the ethic of move fast and break things is inbuilt. And
what I find very hard to reconcile in my mind is the idea that you have the brightest computer science graduates. Okay, Zuck is a dropout, but he's an anomaly. He still was coding from the age of 8.
Yeah.
The best product designers, product managers, experts, mathematicians, designing algos, blah, 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 blah. And yet they fail to consider the negative consequences of the complicated technology they're building. Mm. There is just no way that I can reconcile those thoughts in my mind. Mm. Willful ignorance, the willingness to turn a blind eye towards the negative consequences in pursuit of the dollar bills, that seems way more likely. Way more likely that it's like, oh shit, what if someone kills himself on this? Worry about that later. And then it's like...
Yeah, I think there is an element of truth in the sense that... So recently they put in the feature where you have to have your mobile number to create a Twitter account. And the reason why they didn't have that before was because it added friction to growth. It made it harder for people to sign up. But now you've put phone numbers in, you can't have one guy creating 50 accounts and just trolling underneath, making it look as if, like, you know, there's a conversation going on and there's a million different so you're right, they haven't had the incentive to slow down growth or to worry about what are the externalities of these features. And now it's finally been, they finally had to catch up. And
I think that's exactly the word, like, incentives. Like, what are they incentivizing their staff to achieve, and what are they optimizing for? Facebook ultimately is a publisher now.
Mm.
Twitter, in a similar way, is a publisher.
They don't acknowledge that.
Fine. That's propaganda in itself, in a way. Their own company branding, PR, propaganda. But for the sake of society, in terms of the utility they create, but also like the negative externalities that they create, they are publishers. And I think we need to hold them accountable in that way. And they, therefore, as publishers, need to be thinking about the things that traditional publishers do, like libel and fact-checking and all that kind of stuff.
Our last story, I think we have to mention the whole Kaepernick and Nike thing, or Nike, depending on how you say it. And so off mic, I had to clarify to Abba what the exact controversy is with Kaepernick, and I'll do it quickly for the audience.
Anybody
who has been living under a rock.
Oh, come on. I know the guy. I know who he is.
So
Take a knee.
He took a knee and protested the national anthem in NFL games.
And traditionally, people stand for the national anthem, right? This is it. So, you know, it's all patriotism.
Rah, rah, rah.
But he didn't stand, and he just knelt.
He took a knee to protest police brutality and racial injustice within the country.
Yes.
In actuality, actually, he consulted with a former soldier and said, what is the most respectful way that I can do the protest? And a soldier told him, take a knee, because people take knees sometimes as a form of respect also.
Yes, and so prayer and stuff like that, right?
Correct, right? But anyway, so it hasn't been proven yet, because he's actually in a lawsuit with the NFL, is that the owners colluded to make sure that he wouldn't get a contract and wouldn't get signed again.
Racism.
Yeah, completely. So that lawsuit is currently ongoing. But anyway,
over the knee incident.
He's alleging that they colluded to make sure that he wouldn't get hired, which is technically illegal.
Wow.
So all
because
the owner
it's
said,
not his performance, right?
It's not like his performance. He's a decent player, as far as I'm aware. I don't know nothing about American football, but yeah. So anyways, now it's turned out that behind the scenes, Nike had been paying him the whole time because he hasn't got a contract. And now they've launched this Just Do It. Is it Just Do It? Yeah, the 30th anniversary of the Just Do It campaign with him front and center. Now it's set social media ablaze. Supposedly, it's like $40 million worth of free advertisement that Nike's received.
Just from the shares and the write-ups and all the exposure.
And you got some nutters that are like burning their Nikes. Like one dude actually set fire to his Nikes while he was wearing them.
I'm going to say that.
You know, a natural selection is a beautiful thing, bro. Those people, they just weed themselves out, bro. Like, you got
yo, bro, you got a Nike t-shirt on. Yeah.
Yeah, natural, yeah. Yeah, bro.
Here's a match.
So,
wow.
It's interesting because obviously, like, you can make the argument. I know some people are making the argument about how, you know, Nike is a soulless corporation. They're obviously doing it for their own self-interest. That is, to me, is the most important thing. Nike is doing this out of their own self-interest. Nike realizes that the momentum is with young, progressive people and that America is going to be majority minority by 2040. Black culture basically is what pushes mainstream culture. So they made a bet. They said, we're betting on Kaepernick. And that 40-year-old conservatives, middle-aged white guys, generally speaking, are not going to have any material impact on our company, which is primarily a youth-based company. So regardless of what you say about Nike, Nike is, you know, they've got terrible labor practices overseas, the sweatshop factories, blah, 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 blah. I know all of this stuff already, but I still have to commend what it represents. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't necessarily mean we have to support Nike now and be like, Nike's the greatest thing since ever. No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that.
Phil Knight Shoe Dog.
Yeah, Phil Knight Shoe Dog. I plugged that book last time. But anyways, like, so you seem a bit skeptical.
I am skeptical.
Why?
Because this is the thing, right? I have friends that work in advertising. And how big a risk did Nike really take, right? The controversial ad campaign is nothing new. This idea of creating an ad with the specific intention of sparking controversy is actually a very calculated move that many brands take all the time. The stronger your brand, the bigger the risk you can take, because I guess you can afford the lawyers to fight what potential suits might come. But, you know, we've already quantified the benefit of this campaign, $45 million approximately in extra free advertising just from the amount of press coverage that it's got.
Mm.
I mean, the cynical capitalist side of me feels like it was just a win-win situation on their part, because yes, on the one hand, they are now empathizing with, you know, the progressives, the liberals, the people that are fighting for equality and stuff, which is great, fantastic, but they're also dancing with controversy knowingly and in a very heated, polarized USA / world, where a lot of people can like jump on this and talk about it, whether you're on the left or the right side of the spectrum or right down the middle, you're going to have a comment about this. So I feel like it's really smart.
So it's interesting because before this got released, actually, I was thinking in my head, like, Kaepernick will be celebrated once he's old and frail, like Muhammad Ali was. If you remember Muhammad Ali, he didn't want to go to the Vietnam War, and it was really controversial. He lost his title, everything. He lost his career, basically, for like 4 or 5 years. And
that's when he went from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, right?
He had already joined the Nation of Islam, so he was already Muhammad Ali, but around that same time, he was a pariah. People hated him. And then when he's old and he's ill, that's when everyone's like, Muhammad Ali, you're a hero. That's why I was convinced that, yeah, definitely. He was embraced, like, once he was kind of, like, harmless.
People already liked him.
No, he was hated. I thought that's what was going to happen to Kaepernick. I thought, you know, in 20, 30 years' time, he'll be lauded and he'll be seen as that was so brave. Because even Martin Luther King, for example, now he's celebrated. But at the time when he died, he was seen as an enemy of the US state. And I'm not comparing him to these two people, of course not. But I'm making the point is that the fact that Nike, a soulless multinational corporation, was willing to back this guy in this current climate, doesn't mean that that corporation is good. It just means that the society around it has changed to the point now where it's now profitable to back what is right, because the majority of people now see what is right. That's how I see it. I'm not saying that Nike hasn't made a calculated decision. They have. I know you think it's not much of a risk. I do think it was a bit of a risk, because at the same time, the stock now has dipped.
Yeah, so but the market 2.9% in
but that's billions. That's still like hundreds of millions.
It's going to jump up. Markets are volatile.
Perhaps. But the fact is, the market on a snap decision was like, not sure. And it wasn't because, although most people that are involved in the market are middle-aged white guys, it wasn't because they were like, we don't support this. It was because they thought, as a business decision, we're not sure, because all they care about is the bottom line. So I think it was more of a risk than we realized, but as a calculated risk, it just edged to making that decision. And I think I commend it.
I don't know. I think I'm still staying on the cynical side. I also, like, I'm very much thinking from a perspective of, like, behavioral science and, like, decision-making psychology. You know, Simon Sinek talks about this a lot in his really famous TED Talk, The Power of Why. But we have all of these different layers to our brain. And, like, the most basic, impulsive, instinctive one is that very emotional limbic system, you know? And you're talking about right or wrong, and it's like, if a brand, a soulless, faceless brand like Nike, I mean, how much did Nike donate to Black Lives Matter? Can we get some clarification on that?
As far as I'm aware.
How many of the, you know, black families that lost their sons at the hands of police brutality have Nike sponsored? Do you know what I mean?
None.
Like, but no, what I'm trying to say is, if you attach your brand to a very deep emotional response, like right or wrong, like Black Lives Matter, you've done like an incredibly genius thing, but I can't necessarily like give it full credibility and endorsement unless I know that there's money going that, to that too. You see what I mean? Because what Nike has done with this Kaepernick move, okay, Kaepernick's getting money.
Kaepernick.
He's getting money. By association with him, a lot of black people and people of color and other, like you say, quotation mark, right, or like progressive people are going to give their money to Nike. But what is Nike doing for us? That's all I'm asking. Like, fine, you make nice shoes and clothes and stuff. Maybe you need to work on where they're made and how they're made.
Absolutely.
But if Nike really, really cares, and I, you know, the video is very moving. Don't get me wrong. The video is moving. Serena's a part of this campaign. Serena already got cash. There are like all these like disabled athletes in the campaign. I just want to know, I guess I need to do my research, but I would feel more positive about it if I knew Nike was actually putting money towards these people too.
I think we have to be pragmatic. We can't expect a public multinational company to all of a sudden become an activist company.
But they're capitalizing off of our emotions. Don't you think there's something sinister in that? They are,
but at the same time, they're putting money in a man's pocket who was fired from his job for standing up for what was right.
Right, but so who paid that money? It's Nike. Our money.
Nike paid him.
Yeah, but where does Nike's money come from?
It's customers.
It comes from people like you and me who can't afford to buy houses, but will spend 99 to 250 pounds on shoes.
You can't blame Nike for that.
I'm not blaming Nike for that. But what I'm saying is, like, before we just, like, clap them on the back and send them on their way, let's, like, not forget that, as you said, they are a profitable company.
Yeah,
and now they're capitalizing on our emotions.
Yeah, I mean, but I'd rather them have done this than not done this. And that's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, that's all, that's the main point.
Because it validates the movement? It validates...
I don't think it validates anything. I just think that a company has chosen to stand by somebody who did the right thing. Mm. And that they could have easily have just ducked away from it. And I don't necessarily think it was as low risk as you think it was. I think it could have easily backfired. They took a calculated risk. The irony is actually that Nike has kind of slipped over the years, actually, recently. Like, Adidas has kind of caught up to them because of the whole Kanye Yeezy thing and Under Armour. So Nike, if you think about it, Nike hasn't been in the public discourse in terms of its marketing for a long time. So shout out to Lyft. Apparently they're going public real soon. And obviously the obvious comparisons with Uber, they're not going public apparently till late 2019. So it's looking like Lyft is going to beat them to the punch. Actually, in terms of valuations, Lyft was last valued at $15 billion, you know, chump change, when they raised $600 million, I'm not sure from who, whereas Uber is four times bigger, last valuation $76 billion, which is ginormous for companies that haven't gone public. To have that kind of valuation is crazy. So anyway, Lyft is doing their thing. When it does go public, is it a buy or a sell, or is it, what do you think?
Oh, buy.
It's a buy for you?
Very, very bullish.
On Lyft?
On Lyft, yeah.
Very. Bullish on ride-sharing or just bullish on Lyft?
Well, you know, I have nuanced tastes. I'm definitely, like, a huge fan of Lyft. I'm a huge fan of the product. I know a lot of people at the company. They have, like, strong engineering team.
Biased.
I am biased. And that's also inside information.
Yeah, that's
so
true. We're getting arrested for that.
I'm just going to withdraw that.
Be careful.
No, but I always use Lyft when I'm in the States, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful UX. Can't complain about it.
But is it differentiated enough from Uber?
It is.
You think so?
Yeah, they have better drivers.
Better driver.
They do. They have better quality control. I don't know if that's because they are smaller and so they can. More likely it's just because they prioritized it and optimized for it. I also like that in the latest season of Insecure, shout out HBO's Insecure, Issa Rae is a Lyft driver.
Is she?
Because, you know, being a millennial's hard. She's topping up her income.
Has she fallen on hard times in the show?
Yeah. End of season 1, she breaks up with her boyfriend. So she needs to basically earn more so she can move out on her own in LA. It's hard, you know, when you're co-sharing, cohabitating to pay rent for one. But yeah, no, Lyft, we mentioned on the show before that they're also creating the silent rides.
Like, oh, yeah, you're right. The Zen mode, right? Potentially.
I think they were the first people to do like stickers in the dashboard window and like all that kind of stuff before. And then Uber copied them. Not throwing shade on Uber because I use Uber too. But I feel positive about Lyft. I genuinely feel that my experience of Lyft rides, and I would love to hear feedback on this from the listeners, particularly listeners in America who like use it more regularly, hopefully, or I'm guessing. Every Lyft drive I've had has been a good experience.
Mm.
And not every Uber ride I've had has been a good experience.
What's your worst experience in an Uber, if you don't mind
saying? Oh, wow. Once when I was in SF in January for work, we got picked up by this Uber driver. And his car smelled so badly of weed.
I think you mentioned this actually in one of the previous episodes.
It just stinked of weed and BO. I mean, to be fair, like, he might have been living in his car. In which case, sorry, bro,
because
times is hard. But it was like we had all the windows down the whole ride. And he was also like, seemed a bit stoned, like he missed one of the turns. And then we were like, oh, don't go in the tunnel. The tunnel has traffic. And then he was like, oh, cool, yeah, I'll take the tunnel. And we're like, no, don't. And then he turned into the tunnel. So yeah, that was quite bad. But I've also had bad Uber rides here in London, like drivers who hit the brake at the last possible moment.
Mm.
So you know you're driving and it's like, then, like you're going to get whiplash.
Would you say that you've taken more Ubers than Lyfts?
Oh, absolutely.
So that would increase the chance that you would have a bad experience, right?
Like, well, in terms of probability, yes.
Yeah.
Statistically, yes. But however,
Lyft just generally has a nicer feel to it as a company, right? As in they have their brand. People seem to like it more. They seem to be more cuddly, whereas Uber seems to be just more cutthroat. And
because they went for scale. Uber was just like, grow, grow, grow. And there's always a trade-off. And what I like about Lyft and their decision to, you know, remain in the US only is that they've not had to sacrifice things that Uber has had to in terms of the customer quality and all the other, you know, they're always working to make the app better for drivers. And for customers. Not to say that Uber aren't doing the same. Of course, Uber are doing the same. But like, based on my personal opinion, I would definitely be bullish on Lyft.
So your employer, Ryan Hoover.
Yes.
He tweeted like, I wonder how many like new
my
millionaires.
My employer. He's also my friend.
Your friend and former techish guest.
Yes.
Ryan Hoover. He tweeted something where he was like, I wonder how many like new millionaires are going to be made once Uber and Lyft goes public in the space of a year, right? And there was a few responses. I'll post this all in the show notes. And somebody was like, well, you know, I wouldn't imagine that'd be more than 200 to 300 because most of, and that's for new millionaires, because actually a lot of people that are going to make money off this are established
already
investors.
Millionaires.
Yeah, already millionaires. Like, you know how this game was, the rich, they're rich. But could you imagine being involved in an IPO, just an early stage employee of a company? You didn't necessarily know how far they were going to go. And then all of a sudden, you end up as a millionaire. You never started a company. You never took any outside risk. And I've heard it said before, like, the eighth employee of Facebook probably will make more money than any of us entrepreneurs.
All of us listening right now.
I don't care what company you're starting, you'll never make as much money as probably the eighth employee at Facebook. Like, so could you imagine that situation? Like, you just,
if you're like 20-something, college dropout, looking for an early employee. Holla!
Yeah.
It's just so, I mean, you know, back to probability. It's just so low. It's so low.
Picking the right company to do that.
Yeah, so low.
I think, to be honest, though, like, you might not be able to be, like, a super early stage employee.
Mm.
But, for example, like, we all knew that Airbnb was going to pop after about a year or two when it was out.
Did we?
Yes.
Airbnb came out 2008. I didn't even use it for the first time till 2012.
I think maybe, like, yeah, but that's still kind of early because 2008, they were struggling for a long time.
Oh,
they
really?
Were, yeah, they weren't.
So that's like 4 years.
Yeah. But even then, if you joined in 2012 and they go public in like 2020, for example, you would stand to make a fair bit of change, I think, to be honest. It was pretty obvious that they were going to do something here.
I mean, that was like, Uber tried to poach me a few times and that was always like their sell, like, oh yeah, like, you know, get in now. And like, to be fair, with the amount of funding rounds they've done since, even if you joined Uber like 4 years ago, you'd probably be all right. I mean, I don't really know how much equity they give.
Mm.
But, you know, let's not like discount the value of more mature but massive tech companies. When I was at Amazon, obviously I didn't stay, but if I did, my equity would have been like 250k.
Mm.
And I obviously could have got more as I got promoted every year and stuff like that.
You fucked up. We're out here struggling. We're out here hustling. Every day we try something. You're telling me that you could have 250k. Listen, forget this morals thing. Forget this morals thing. Forget it.
And Facebook
250. Jeez. I'm sure it's just me. Like, enough, man. Anyways.
Yeah, but how much value do you put on your time?
Yeah, your time. Yeah, and your peace of mind. Like, peace of mind. About 250.
That actually reminds me of a tweet that I saw. So Stephanie Hubert, who's like a software tech company founder, did a Twitter poll, which was like, would you work at a company that you hated?
Mm.
Long hours, no free time, just miserable.
How much?
For 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But in those 3 years, you earned enough money that you never have to work again.
Yeah, 100% I'll do that.
Or would you...
I'm all still posing the question. I was like, it's done. No, you know what? It depends in terms of like, there's companies that I hate, for example. Like, I don't hate Uber, for example. But let's say you might say to me, Michael, you don't
Trump
agree
administration.
With... You don't, yeah.
Trump if, administration.
So there's companies that I dislike. So Uber, I don't like how they go about things sometimes. But there are companies where I'm like, I fundamentally don't agree with, you know, your world view, like the Trump administration. It's not a company, but, you know, I could work there hypothetically. Or... there's so many, like, I don't even want to name them because it's going to get real political, but there's so many organizations and companies that I just don't agree with that I actually think you're doing a bad thing in this world. Like, I wish you didn't exist.
Yeah.
For that, oh, it's still difficult.
The thing is, it's so, anyone that's like, yeah, do it, yeah, do it. Anyone that's saying that has never had a job.
That they hated. No, but the vast majority of people have jobs
no,
that they don't want
like,
to do.
But this is the thing, like...
That's why we call them jobs. And not like... We call them jobs because, like, you wouldn't do this if you weren't getting paid.
I'm talking about those kind of, like, well-compensated but just soul-destroying, time-sucking jobs. Like, I always say of my time at Amazon, like, I was just too young. Like, I just wasn't ready to be in a company that operated at that pace. I wanted to be in a startup. I wanted to be somewhere faster.
Okay.
And it moved like a big corporate. You know, maybe when I'm older, I'll, like, look back at things differently and be like, oh, okay, yeah, actually, it's not so bad. Like, it's a good place to work now. But... Mm. When you're in that position, you know, you're waking up at like 6 a.m. or earlier, commuting, no one's talking to you, you're working on some Excel book.
Yeah, it's hell.
You know, it's, and like 3 years feels like an eternity.
I think I would say if I pose this question to my friends that have kids, they would do it without a shadow of a doubt.
True.
Someone like me, I would probably be like, I've got the luxury to be like, I've got other alternatives, I'm not really on it. But if I've got mouths to feed and it's not just about me anymore, then yeah, I probably would have to do it. That's the serious. Well, if I got dependents, if like, you know, you got a parent that, you know, needs you, like, and you got to kick money up to them all the time, then you might have to do it.
Back to the topic of millionaires. One of the things I was going to say is, so when I was in SF last week or the week before, whenever it was, I heard about someone who basically had left someone's team. I don't
like, someone who's left someone's team.
I don't
know. Okay,
this is very vague. Okay, so basically someone left a friend's team.
Okay.
Right. A salesperson left my friend's team. So my friend works in a tech company.
Okay, and he was in charge of this team.
And
their
he has
friend
a team.
Left. And this person left that you know
and
also.
And this person left his team. Okay, I don't know this person. I don't know this person. But through hearsay, it basically like came back that they had got a sales role at Facebook.
Okay.
And like the comp is crazy six figs, like Jeez. Crazy six figs, including significant equity. So you might think,
Damn.
Okay, Facebook is public, it's late stage, you're Mm-mm. probably going to get 0.000 whatever equity. Nah, like the value of the equity is so high that even if you're getting like few basis points or whatever, it's significant enough. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like we've spoken on the show before, if you really want to be a millionaire, don't be thinking like, okay, like what super early stage company can I be employee number 5 of and work my way up?
Mm.
Because the probability of that tactic succeeding is like way lower than you, you know, leveraging your skills to get a decent job in a more mature tech company where basically you can negotiate for much healthier compensation and then with like good investing and good saving, like over time. Save up to be a millionaire.
Yeah, I was gonna say I disagree, but you're right. If you're someone who earns like six figures, and you've got equity, the company's giving you equity, and you live a humble, frugal lifestyle, you can be a millionaire within like 15, 20 years, fair enough. But if you're like me and you wanna be a millionaire like that,
no,
you know what I'm saying?
Billionaire,
that's too slow. Nah, but I'm joking.
I'm on that trillionaire.
I would say to someone though, I would generally advise people that try to join a company that hasn't gone public, but it's obvious they're gonna blow. An Airbnb even 4 years ago, like an Uber 4 years ago. If you just wanna make money, okay, if you don't care about like, you know, what does the company do, or like, do I agree with the ethics of the company? If you're like, I'm starting off,
what are the companies like that? You tell me.
I mean, some people say Uber's like that. Uber's quite unethical,
but they're already IPOing next year, so that's too
late. Oh, what are the companies like that now?
Yeah, early stage.
Oh, that's a good point. Gee, you put me on the spot. That's difficult, actually. Yeah, I can't think of any right now.
Well,
but people do say that there's been a big You know, like every 10 years we'll have our wave of companies, and there hasn't really been, like, since Snapchat, there hasn't really been anything where you're like, wow, in the last 5 years.
What, this consumer company, tech? Transformative? Consumer tech.
Yeah.
What about like Twitch and things like that?
Yeah, maybe
what
Bird, about? These whole new scooter crap.
Yeah, scooters, why not?
Problem with that though is you don't know which the winner.
Oculus?
Oculus has gone pop. Apparently, it's been acquired.
The reviews of that are not great.
Yeah,
either.
It's not great. Yeah, that's two things. But I'll mention those scooter companies. The problem is there's quite a few of them and they're all quite undifferentiated. So how do you know which one to join?
Well, whichever one matches your outfit, obviously.
But you want to... Anyways. Yeah, like,
one thing I'm going to say.
I took you seriously. I was like, I really thought you were being serious there for a second. I was like, what?
That's anyways. How I get you. Yeah. Airbnb.
Mm.
Company we all know. I went to their new offices in San Francisco. They don't sponsor this show, but maybe they should
you're
after I say
this. You're a tech insider, aren't you? You're an insider, man.
So shout out Jonathan Z White, my homie that invited me. So I go to Airbnb for lunch and they have the most insane lunch. Now, okay, it's a standard in Silicon Valley to get free lunch, okay? It's too expensive to eat, so you have to feed your employees, otherwise they die. Everyone knows that. But what was crazy about this was they were like, oh yeah, there's a hot options. There's like vegan, veggie, blah, blah, blah. There's a salad bar, la, la, la. And I was like, oh, what's over there? And there's like this little like stand with like two chefs behind it and all these like lovely little plates with like a drizzle of jus and whatever. And he was like, oh, they do a different gourmet taster every day. And I was like, what? I roll up to this table. They have steak tartare with a little drizzle of la la la. I was so like, bougie. What? I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I rejected Airbnb.
There we go, you fucked up. For a quick question, it's not really a hustle tip. It's more of a hustle question, which I want to post to ABBA. Because
hustle question.
It's a context that I find myself in quite.
Yeah, I'll give you a hustle answer.
Yeah. So basically, like I'll get people reaching out to me saying, listen, I've got this startup idea. I'm looking for a CTO. What do I do?
Oh my god.
And it's
gosh.
Like I'm like
god.
If you had
the most uttered phrase in the
text. It's like I'm looking yeah, it's so commonly CTO. Uttered, but I don't know what to say to people because I understand the predicament. It's difficult. Like
99% of MVPs do not need code. This is what really upsets me.
But then the thing
me.
Is like so for example, I won't give too much details, but these people had already built an MVP. They had paid for an MVP.
Oh dear.
Yeah. And it worked. Oh, and they were trying to raise money. So then they were like, do you know anyone like a potential CTO? And I was like, I can ask in my network, but you know, it's very difficult like for me to go to people and say, these guys have got, I don't know. It's hard. It's a very tough sell. Like in order to reel in a CTO, I've never had to do it. Cause in the end, I just gave up. I said, you know what? I'm just going to learn to code. Cause I just thought, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of like having to be in that position of asking for things that people are not responsive or willing to help. But not everyone's got the time to want to do that. Like if you're a full-time job, that might detour you for a whole year.
Or you have other skills and you want to be like the marketing oriented person
exactly.
or whatever.
But if you are going to go to somebody who's technical and try to pitch them to come on board, you have to be coming with a lot. Don't come to with an idea. Number one, don't come with an idea. Thank God these guys didn't do that. They were actually, you know, about their business. If you come with an idea, it's worthless because ideas are a dime a dozen. You don't think that CTO potential person hasn't got their own ideas that they want to use? Come with something. Whether it's a mock-up at the very least, whether it's customers, like actually that is probably more important.
This is the thing.
If you come with customers and you're like, listen, I've got people that are willing to give me money. I've got the business model all figured out. Here's a mock-up. Are you willing to come on board? Then you're starting. If you're coming with ideas, get the hell out of it. And even then, if you've got customers, you've just got to make it real. You've got to have stuff on the table that's going to make the CTO think, I couldn't do this by myself. Do you know what I mean? I need this person. This person has some domain expertise. You know, maybe they worked in a hedge fund and they've got this idea for a hedge fund software that's going to revolutionize the game. And I don't know anything about hedge funds and they've got customers lined up and they've got the network and they've got you know, everything. It's got to be like that. You can't just be like, guys, I want to build, you know, an app for dogs to be babysitted. I don't know. Dog sitting app, something.
Dog babysitter.
Yeah. Dog sitting app. Like anyways, but so I wanted to ask this to you because you've been in that situation where you wrote a really great article about, you know, I built my company with that code,
yes.
Basically, right? So what advice would you give to a founder that came to you and said, I'm in this predicament, what do I do?
Funnily enough, I had the exact same situation last week. So
okay.
I was at
this is more common than I realized. It's bloody common.
It's ridiculously common. I was at a Geek Girl meetup.
Yeah.
Shout out Geek Girl meetup.
So. That was last Thursday, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool, yeah.
So I was at their summer party and they did this thing, speed pitching. So they had like 22 people with 1 minute on stage. half of the people were like, hi, I have an idea for an app that does blah, 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 and I'm looking for a CTO. Hi, I have an idea for an app that does blah, 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 I'm looking for a CTO. Literally every single one of those ideas, which is still just at idea phase, could create an MVP with no code. They could create an MVP using Card, using Squarespace. Product Hunt, the company I work for, which was bought for millions and millions of dollars, a reported $20 million, started as an email chain, literally a newsletter. Ryan Hoover sending out to a bunch of people, hey, these are the cool products that we're looking at. From there, you get seed funding or pre-seed or angel or whatever. Like, I don't know if it's a lack of education about how to develop as a tech entrepreneur, or if people are quite egotistical about their ideas and the grandness of their ideas, that they feel that, you know, even things like zero code, bubble.is, you can actually drag and drop to then create full stack code so that if you did later want to jump into Terminal and fool around with it or whatever, you could. So it's not even like when I say to people, you know, make an MVP with the tools available to you, I'm saying you are limited to things like Squarespace and WordPress. Not at all. Like, if you need to make a chatbot, you can use Notion. Like, there are so many tools out there that can let you build, like, relatively complex software. Like, okay, fair enough. Like, if you're in, like, a very complicated vertical, doing something with, like, agriculture that requires hardware, or doing something in biotech, you're splitting or AI atoms. Right now, or like, okay, fine. In that case, yes, you do need a domain expertise. But let me tell you this. If you are coming up with an idea in one of those complicated verticals and you are not owning the expertise to do that anyway, you're in the wrong vertical. Like, I'm not going to, like, jump in and be like, I have this incredible idea for, like, some synthetic chemical. Nah.
Yeah.
Like, you got to be the person with domain expertise saying that. So I guess, like, what my advice is for people out there looking for a CTO, or for people who often get that question, point people in the direction of the Lean Startup book. Like, I know Lean Startup isn't the only way of doing it, but it's the most popular proven method that we have right now. Point them in the direction of that book, or point them in the direction of Eric Ries, like, videos on YouTube. Really push them to come up with an MVP idea. Or, you know, if you're a founder looking for a CTO, push yourself to come up with an MVP. And if that MVP still needs code, strip it back. Ultimately, like, for most people at the earliest stages, all you're trying to do is validate an idea with customer interest. Sometimes that can be as easy as a sign-up page. So Founders Factory, they're an accelerator here.
Yeah.
What they do before they start building anything, set up a landing page, brand it, and then write a few lines about what the product will do.
Yeah.
So it might be like, okay, cool, we're building a travel app where you pay a subscription fee of £30 a month, and then you can go on holiday four times a year or whatever. Are you interested? Buy some Facebook ads. 20,000 people sign up in the first month. Okay, cool, we're going to build it now.
Yeah.
And similar things happen on Product Hunt with our product ship. You can build a landing page. This is what we're working on. How does this sound? If you're interested to find out more, subscribe here. Boom. It went from one person to 100 people to thousands of people. Now you're like, okay, cool. Now, with that list of 10,000 emails, you go and find an angel investor. You go on angel.co. I'm like plugging all my companies now. But like literally, you don't want to be the person, like Michael said, that only has an idea, doesn't have domain expertise, and does not have cash out there trying to hunt for engineers. Because let me tell you guys, supply and demand, the demand exceeds supply greatly.
Yeah.
And everyone wants the same thing. Hi, I want a full stack engineer. You don't even know what full stack means. Educate yourself.
Abba's killing me right now.
No, but people are annoying me. And then I'm like pushing them for more. I'm like, why do you need a full stack engineer? Oh, because I need to do this and I need to do that and it's complicated and it's whatever. And I was like, no, it's not that complicated.
I think that particular, like, scenario that you outlined, I feel like that comes with a lot of naivety. And when you're young, perhaps, where you've gone through school and everything has always just been like ABC right in front of you, as in the steps are logically there. Whereas this now, of convincing somebody to believe in your vision, to do the hard homework of finding out how far can I go without this person, and then when I get to that stage, bring that person on board, it's really hard. It's not easy. Thankfully, the people that I was speaking to, that the original scenario that I brought up, they had built something, but there were still things that they hadn't done. Like, they didn't have a landing page. So I was like, what do I show people? Oh, we have the MVP, but they have to sign an NDA. I'm like, guys, you're making it difficult now. Have a landing page, right? How many signups do you have? Like you said, I didn't even tell them that. They should have a landing page, run some Facebook ads, and say, we've got 10,000 people already willing to use the app.
Exactly. Exactly.
That is tangible. That is tangible. And it's difficult because most people that are CTO ready have well-paid jobs.
They don't
want to
work on your stupid idea for free. I'm sorry. I know you think your idea is great, but guess what? It's really not.
Yeah. And they have well-paid jobs and they have their own ideas. A quick, funny side tangent. When I was at university doing computer science and stuff, like a lot of engineers would go to like the Entrepreneur Society and like watch their like demo day and just like take their best ideas.
What?
We'd be like, yeah, it's so ruthless. I mean, I wouldn't do it, but there'll be people there with me. They'll be like, yeah, rocket internet style. They'll be like, oh, so we've got like a whole bunch of enthusiastic entrepreneurs that have ideas and they haven't got no CTOs to build their products. Okay, cool. What is this? Any good ideas? Cool. No. And then bop off and be like, let's try and build this.
Nice. Hey, man, that's capitalism.
It's capitalism. Nah, I'm joking. I don't sanction that whatsoever. But
I don't think there's any shame in that.
No, but
ideas are original.
Why that's an interesting heuristic is because somebody shouldn't be able to leave that demo day pitch and just copy your idea. You should have something done already. Like, for example, I've got 10,000 emails.
Exactly.
People signed up, right?
Facebook group.
Someone like me who's a hacker, I might hear that and be like, right, you got a Facebook group, 10,000 people or emails? I can't be bothered to replicate that. Whereas if you're just going to be like, I need someone to write some code and I have got nothing else, no assets, no brand, no, you know, for example, look at Charmadine Reed. I'll give her as an example. She is not a technical co-founder. She had a nail salon, very capable entrepreneur, but she had a brand built up. She had equity built up in terms of who she was. She had a platform.
And a
following. So she could go to technical people and say, build this app. Without me, you're never going to get this. Whatever you're going to build isn't going to reach the audience that I want to touch because I have access to this audience through my platform. Things like that. I'm not saying go out there and get 100,000 Instagram followers, but what I'm saying is have something that can't be replicated just by the engineer on their own. Because if they don't need you, why have you on board?
This is such a good way of looking at it. Brings episode 23 of Techish to a close. Don't forget to leave us a review if you haven't already. Share an episode with a friend. You can support our work on Patreon. You can come see us in real life at the North Zone Conference first weekend of October in Philadelphia. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm on at Abadesi. Michael is on at Michael Verhaen _.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, yeah.
You can also check out our websites at Hustle Crew Live or hustlecrew.co and
peopleofcolorintech.com, and also check out techishpod.com, which is our website for this podcast.
Yeah, as always, leave us feedback. What can we do better? What do you like? What do you not like? Do you agree with me and Michael? Yes or no? We never agree anyway.
Yeah, it's true.
Cool.
See you next week. Ciao. Bye.